Okay, so we come to the next book in our Old Testament survey, the book of Joshua, which, as I mentioned to somebody last week, I've come up with a title, which is God in General. So it covers first the military conquest of Canaan by the Israelites, as directed by God, and second, the allotment of the land to the tribes of Israel. I thought I mentioned at the beginning, there's not too many commentaries on Joshua to choose from. A few resources that I used in case you're interested, but you know, if you think this is really bad, then afterwards don't. You might want to actually go to the source. One is called is this book by Francis Schaeffer called Joshua and the Flow of Biblical History, which I think is pretty good. It's not a commentary per se, and he does tend to go off on other topics of interest that are relevant to the passages, but still, it's a pretty good book. Calvin had his commentary on Joshua. That's available, or should be available online at www.ccl.org. Although when I checked last night or this morning, the funny thing is when you went on to the book of Joshua, it took you to an Italian Bible, which I didn't find particularly helpful. Also, there is a book by Arthur Pink called Gleanings in Joshua. It's according to our church website, it's in our church library. But you don't have to go to that trouble because it's also on the web. If you need the address, I won't just see me. Or you can Google on Pink Gleanings Joshua and I think you'll find it right off. One other thing was an article in the Reformed Theological Journal by Hugh Blair called Preaching from the Book of Joshua. So, anyways, just thought I'd mention those at the beginning. Okay, on authorship and date of the book, I'm sorry to disappoint you, but I know relatively little about authorship and date other than what's in the front of the New Geneva Study Bible. From what we can tell, it seems to have been written contemporaneously or relatively soon thereafter. In Joshua 5:1, it says, "So it was when all the kings of the Amorites who were on the west side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites who were by the sea heard that the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan from before the children of Israel until we had crossed over, that their heart melted. There was no spirit in them any longer because of the children of Israel." So, I don't know. My reading of the "until we had crossed over" is that the author had actually crossed over. So that's written at least near to the time. Okay, why study Joshua? Well, I mean, the obvious reason is we're doing an Old Testament survey, and it's the next book. But, you know, I guess we might ask ourselves, why should we do more than this? And if it's just a book about military conquest and allotment of land, why should we study it? And, of course, some of us would say if it was a book on military conquest, that's reasonably interesting in and of itself. But this is... some people put it more strongly. Here's a quote from a book called The Authority of the Old Testament. "The book of Joshua is anything but the best-loved book in the Bible. It is a book with which many preachers feel that they cannot honestly operate. Now and then one hears the wish expressed that it was not in the Bible at all. It tells a bloody tale of battle, violence, and wholesale slaughter, a slaughter in which God assists with his mighty acts. The smoke of burning towns and the stench of rotting flesh hangs over its pages. What is worse, not only did God assist in the slaughter, it is more than once stated that he expressly commanded it. It is a story of fanaticism, of holy war, and wholesale sacrificial destruction." Okay. "And sensitive folk cry out, as they always have, 'What is such a story doing in the Bible? You simply cannot preach from this book.'" Or Patrick Fairbairn, writing in the mid-19th century, said, "The possession of that land formed one of the most prominent provisions in the Abrahamic covenant. And as matters actually stood when the fulfillment came to be accomplished, the possession could be made good only by the overthrow and destruction of the original inhabitants. This mode of entrance of the possession on the possession has been often denounced by infidel writers as cruel and unjust, and has not unfrequently met with a lame defense from the advocates of divine revelation. Even heathen morality is said to have been offended at it. And we learn from Augustine that the ancient sect of the Manichaeans, who were more pagan than Christian in their sentiments, placed it among, quote, the many cruel things which Moses did and commanded, and which went to prove, according to their view, that the God of the Old Testament could not be the God of the New." So, and Fairbairn went on to explain what he meant by a lame defense, and one of the things that I was interested in was apparently some people have claimed that Joshua essentially wrote an open letter to the Canaanites, offering them three choices. They could flee, they could submit, or they could fight. Okay, that this possession isn't, that this position isn't supported by Scripture, we're not going to dwell on. So, okay, well, with all this, what's all this against Joshua, what can be said for it? Well, I think quite a lot. It's important in terms of continuity between the Pentateuch and the rest of the Old Testament. I'm not going to draw this out too much more, but Schaefer makes the point that there, at least among, say, I would say people are sort of oriented towards higher criticism, there's often the thought that, you know, from Joshua and later, there's some archaeological evidence and so on for the various things that happened, but the part before that is just, you know, complete fantasy. And Schaefer points out that there's this very direct connection between what happens in the Pentateuch and what, and then the book of Joshua and so on. So it forms a bridge sort of between the Pentateuch and the rest of the Old Testament. There's the historical significance, as an example, right? And some key themes are God's judgment on sin and God's faithfulness. And there's the theological significance, the meaning of God's rest, and what we might call Christological significance. Christ appears in typological form. Joshua is a type of Christ. And also in person in the book. So we'll get to the, we'll get to those things eventually. Hopefully this won't be a classic Spittler overview of something that takes, you know, quite a bit longer than for you to study it yourself, but we'll see. But in way of speaking partly about the bridge, I was going to introduce Joshua, General Joshua, he is introduced in the Pentateuch, and I thought I'd talk a little bit about what sort of training he had, what we learn about him in the earlier before we get to actually the book of Joshua. So we first meet Joshua as the Israelites were wandering in the wilderness. The Amalekites were a nomadic tribe descended from Esau. They attacked the Israelites. In fact, Deuteronomy 25 tells us that in 17 and 18, remember what Amalek did to you on the way as you were coming out of Egypt, how he met you on the way and attacked your rear ranks, all the stragglers at your rear when you were tired and weary, and he did not fear God. So, you know, as you can imagine, a group this size gets kind of strung out. People probably travel at different paces, and the Amalekites attack their stragglers, which presumably would have included not their main military forces, you know, perhaps women and children and the more feeble. So, in Exodus 17, we have an account here. It starts in verse 8. Now Amalek came and fought with Israel in Rephidim, and Moses said to Joshua, "Choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on the top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand." So Joshua did as Moses said to him and fought with Amalek. And Moses, Aaron, and Hur went up to the top of the hill. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hands became heavy. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and the other on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. So Joshua defeated Amalek and his people with the edge of the sword. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Write this for a memorial in the book and recount it in the hearing of Joshua, that I will utterly blot out the remembrance of Amalek from under heaven." And Moses built an altar and called its name, "The Lord is my banner." For he said, "Because the Lord is sworn, the Lord will have war with Amalek from generation to generation." So, I don't know, this is a great story of one of the battles of the Old Testament, and think a little bit about what sort of lessons Joshua might have learned. I mean, Joshua is like the rest of us, he might have been tempted to think, "What a great general I am. You know, I beat the Amalekites." But of course, that's not the lesson that we think he learned from this, right? Because Amalek prevailed whenever Moses put down the rod, I think that Joshua may have learned that power is often derivative, that it doesn't flow from chariots, horses, and soldiers, and that, but rather it's God's power that's authoritative. And of course, the Israelites needed good military planning and capability. I'm not trying to take away from Joshua's military expertise, but ultimately, it's God's power that prevails. And God ordains both the ends, the end that happens, and the means. And as we'll see later in Joshua, God often uses apparently ordinary means to deliver great victories. So, I mean, there's some miraculous victories that, seem clearly supernatural, and others that seem like good military strategy, execution. Okay, also, God ordered that it be written down in the book, right? That's in verse 14 of Exodus 17. Write this for a memorial in the book. Right, and the book, of course, is the Bible, and it becomes a key part of Joshua's directive, and we'll come back to that. So, okay, so Joshua shows up again in in Exodus 24, and this is after Israel had reaffirmed the covenant. Moses and 70 elders went up on Mount Sinai, starting in verse 9. Then Moses went up, also Aaron, Nadab, and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and they saw the God of Israel. And there was under his feet, as it were, a paved work of sapphire stone, and it was like the very heavens in its clarity. But on the nobles of the children of Israel he did not lay his hand. So they saw God, and they ate and drank. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Come up to me on the mountain and be there, and I will give you tablets of stone, and the law and the commandments which I have written, that you may teach them." So Moses arose with his assistant Joshua, and Moses went up to the mountain of God. And he said to the elders, "Wait here for us until we come back to you. Indeed, Aaron and Hur are with you. If any man has a difficulty, let him go to them." Then Moses went up to the mountain, and a cloud covered the mountain. Now the glory of the Lord rested on Mount Sinai, and the cloud covered it 6 days. And on the seventh day he called to Moses out of the midst of the cloud. The sight of the glory of the Lord was like a consuming fire on the top of the mountain in the eyes of the children of Israel. Okay, well, this must have been quite an awesome experience where the reality, glory, and presence of God were clearly demonstrated. Moses spent some time on the mountain with God. He was given all kinds of directives on the Ark of the Testimony, the tabernacle, its furnishing, priestly garments. This goes on basically from chapter 24 to 32, all the things that God communicated to Moses. Consecration of priests, and God gives them two tablets of stone, the testimony, which I believe is the Ten Commandments, so that's what we're thinking anyways. And Joshua is sort of a witness to this, and then, of course, there's something else going on at the same time. While Moses was with God, the people are down below rebelling. They'd made a golden calf and had proceeded to engage in one big orgy. God sent Moses back down the mountain, told him to get down because the people are rebelling. And he caught up to Joshua, and when he did, in Exodus 32, verse 17, when Joshua heard the noise of the people as they shouted, he said to Moses, "There is a noise of war in the camp." But he said, "It is not the noise of the shout of victory, nor the noise of the cry of defeat, but the sound of singing I hear." So it was, as soon as he came near the camp, that he saw the calf and the dancing. So Moses' anger became hot, and he cast the tablets out of his hands and broke them at the foot of the mountain. Then he took the calf which they had made, burned it in the fire, and ground it to powder. He scattered it on the water and made the children of Israel to drink it. And Moses said to Aaron, "What did this people do to you that you have brought so great a sin upon them?" So Aaron said, "Do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, that they are set on evil. For they said to me, 'Make us gods that shall go out before us.' For as for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." And I said to them, "Whoever has any gold, let them break it off." So they gave it to me, and I cast it into the fire, and this calf came out. Now, just as an aside, I think this is one of the all-time lamest excuses ever given. We threw the gold in the fire, and this calf came out. Now when Moses saw that the people were unrestrained, for Aaron had not restrained them, to their shame among their enemies, then Moses stood at the entrance of the camp and said, "Whoever is on the Lord's side, come to me." And all the sons of Levi gathered themselves together to him. And he said to them, "Thus says the Lord God of Israel, let every man put his sword on his side, and go in and out from entrance to entrance throughout the camp, and let every man kill his brother, every man his companion, and every man his neighbor." So the sons of Levi did according to the word of Moses, and about 3,000 men of the people fell that day. So, again, what lessons might Joshua have learned? I think a very important one is the terrible nature of sin among God's people. You know, it's the price for this was 3,000 men losing their lives. Also, merely using the name of the Lord wasn't sufficient. Right? I mean, the people said, oh, this golden calf, this is the Lord, you know, that brought us out of Egypt. Also, perhaps, there is a place for godly anger. Except that in Moses' case, his anger was basically for God's sake, that the people were rebelling against him. It wasn't the people rebelling against Moses. Let's see. Joshua appears again in Exodus 33. In verses 7 through 11, it says that, starting in verse 8. So it was whenever Moses went out to the tabernacle that all the people rose, and each man stood at his tent door and watched Moses until he'd gone into the tabernacle. And it came to pass when Moses entered the tabernacle that the pillar of cloud descended and stood at the door of the tabernacle, and the Lord talked with Moses. And the people saw the pillar of the cloud standing at the tabernacle door, and all the people rose and worshipped each man in his tent door. So the Lord spoke to Moses face to face as a man speaks to his friend. And he would return to the camp, but his servant Joshua, the son of Nun, a young man, did not depart from the tabernacle. Okay, and then skipping to verse 24. So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord, and he gathered the 70 men of the elders of the people and placed them around the tabernacle. Then the Lord came down to the cloud and spoke to him and took of the Spirit that was upon him and placed the same upon the 70 elders. And it happened, when the Spirit rested upon them, that they prophesied, although they never did so again. But two men had remained in the camp. The name of one was Eldad, the name of the other Medad. And the Spirit rested upon them. Now they were among those listed, but who had not gone out to the tabernacle, yet they prophesied in the camp. And a young man ran and told Moses and said, Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp. So Joshua the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, one of his choice men, answered and said, Moses, my Lord, forbid them. Then Moses said to them, are you zealous for my sake? Oh, that all the Lord's people were prophets, and the Lord would put a spirit upon them. So again, lesson, God's glory comes first. To quote Francis Schaeffer, the young man Joshua is learning a lesson that anybody who is ever going to be worth anything in leadership must learn. None of us learns it completely, of course, and yet we must master it if we are going to be of any use in the Church of God. Leader must never confuse himself with God. When a person begins to exercise certain gifts and God brings him to a place of leadership in the Church of Christ, how easy it is to do this. Yet this is the destruction of all true spiritual leadership. So, anyways, I thought that was a useful quote to think about. Okay, Joshua next appears as one of the 12 spies sent to spy out the land of Canaan. His name, though, was given earlier actually as Hoshea, meaning salvation. In Numbers 13:16, we're told that Moses changes his name. It says that Moses called Hoshea the son of Nun Joshua. Joshua meaning Jehovah is his help or Jehovah the Savior. Okay, I think most of you are probably familiar with the story of how the spies went into Canaan and how they were all basically agreed, all 12 were agreed, that it was a land flowing with milk and honey. Okay, there was no question about what a rich and wonderful land it was. But the majority report, 10 of the spies, said that the land was populated with giants that would be impossible to subdue. And only Caleb and Joshua disagreed. And the result, from Numbers 14, interestingly enough, was that so all the congregation lifted up their voices and cried, and the people wept that night. And all the children of Israel complained against Moses and Aaron, and the whole congregation said to them, if only we had died in the land of Egypt, or if only we had died in this wilderness. Just wait. Wow. Why has the Lord brought us to this land to fall by the sword, that our wives and children should become victims? Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us select a leader and return to Egypt. Then Moses and Aaron fell on their faces before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. But Joshua the son of Nun and Caleb the son of Jephunneh, who were among those who had spied out the land, tore their clothes. And they spoke to all the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." And all the congregation said to stone them with stones. Now the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before all the children of Israel. Okay, I like that confidence. The people of the land are our bread. Okay, so again, what lessons might Joshua learn? Well, first of all, the majority report isn't necessarily right. Right, that's what, since we sort of idolize democracy in our own land, sometimes tempted to think that the majority must be right. Right, so when there's a difference between the majority report and God's directives, Joshua knew where his responsibility lay. Another lesson is that that leaders can't expect to make everyone or even most of the people happy. Right? Later on, of course, Joshua, 38 years later, did lead the people into the land. But at that point, his responsibility was to tell the truth and lay it on the line. It didn't make people very happy. Again, another lesson is, for a second time, is this terrible nature of rebellion against God. Right, all the adults in this crowd ended up dying in the wilderness. Right, they took 2 months from the time they left Egypt to get to Sinai. It took 2 months, and then they took another year in the Sinai, where they received, they rebelled, but they also received the law and so on. Right, then they were literally 14 months after they left Egypt. They were right at the promised land, but because of their sin, they ended up wandering. Another 38 years in the wilderness. They spent 40 years total. And in this time, Joshua saw every other adult besides himself and Caleb die. And God's judgment, it may be slow, but it grinds exceedingly fine. And I think this is a good example of this particular truism literally every adult died that had rebelled. And also, of course, Joshua saw how God kept his promise and how he distinguished between men in history. Okay, so as the time then in the wilderness comes to an end, some 38 years later, Moses has been told that he will not enter the promised land, and God has him ordained Joshua. And Moses is directed to, in the words of the NKJV, inaugurate Joshua. And from Numbers 27, starting in verse 18, "And the Lord said to Moses, 'Take Joshua the son of Nun with you, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him. Set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and inaugurate him in their sight. And you shall give some of your authority to him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient. He shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire before the Lord for him by the judgment of the Urim. At his word they shall go out, and at his word they shall come in, he and all the children of Israel with him, all the congregation.' So Moses did as the Lord commanded him. He took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest, and before all the congregation. He laid his hands on him and inaugurated him, just as the Lord commanded by the hand of Moses." So Moses publicly endorsed and commands Joshua, and in Deuteronomy 31, it says, "Then Moses went and spoke all these words to Israel, and he said to them, 'I am 120 years old today. I can no longer go out and come in. Also the Lord has said to me, you shall not cross over this Jordan. The Lord your God himself crosses over before you. He will destroy these nations from before you, and you shall dispossess them. Joshua himself crosses over before you, just as the Lord has said. The Lord will do that to them as he did to Sihon and Og, kings of the Amorites in their land, when he destroyed them. The Lord will give them over to you, that you may do to them according to every commandment which I have commanded you. Be strong of good courage. Do not fear nor be afraid of them, for the Lord your God, he is the one who goes with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Then Moses called Joshua and said to him in the sight of all Israel, be strong and of good courage, for you must go with this people to the land which the Lord has sworn to their fathers to give them, and you shall cause them to inherit it. And the Lord, he is the one who goes before you. He will be with you. He will not leave you nor forsake you. Do not fear nor be dismayed. And skipping down to verse 14. Then the Lord said to Moses, behold, the days approach when you must die. Call Joshua and present yourselves in the tabernacle of meeting that I may inaugurate him. So Moses and Joshua went and presented themselves in the tabernacle of meeting. Now the Lord appeared at the tabernacle in a pillar of cloud, and the pillar of cloud stood above the door of the tabernacle. Okay. So, literally now, right on the right across the Jordan River, Joshua and the people get their marching orders. And starting in Deuteronomy 34, verse 9, reading through Deuteronomy 35, which incidentally is the same as Joshua 1. So you'll see it's repeated. So, you know, we've taken most of the class, and we're finally going to cross into the promised book here in five verses. Now Joshua the son of Nun was full of the spirit of wisdom, for Moses had laid his hands on him. So the children of Israel heeded him, and did as the Lord commanded Moses. But since there has not arisen in Israel a prophet like Moses, whom the Lord knew face to face, and all the signs and wonders which the Lord had sent him to do in the land of Egypt, before Pharaoh, before all his servants, and in all his land. And by all that mighty power and all that great terror which Moses performed in the sight of all Israel. Okay, now Deuteronomy 35, verse 1. After the death of Moses, the servant of the Lord, it came to pass that the Lord spoke to Joshua, the son of Nun, Moses' assistant, saying, Moses, my servant, is dead. Now therefore arise, go over this Jordan, you and all this people, to the land which I am giving to them, the children of Israel. Every place that the sole of your foot will tread upon, I have given you, as I said to Moses. From the wilderness and this Lebanon, as far as the great river, the river Euphrates, all the land of the Hittites, into the great sea toward the going down of the sun, shall be your territory. No man shall be able to stand before you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will not leave you nor forsake you. Be strong and of good courage, for to this people you shall divide as an inheritance the land which I swore to their fathers to give them. Only be strong and very courageous, that you may observe to do according to all the law which Moses my servant commanded you. Do not turn from it to the right hand or to the left, that you may prosper wherever you go. This book of the law shall not depart from your mouth, but you shall meditate in it day and night, that you may observe to do according to all that is written in it. For then you will make your way prosperous, and then you will have good success. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and of good courage. Do not be afraid nor be dismayed, for the Lord your God is with you wherever you go. Then Joshua commanded the officers of the people, saying, pass through the camp and command the people, saying, prepare provisions for yourselves, for within 3 days you will cross over this Jordan to go in to possess the land which the Lord your God is giving you to possess. And you notice this is kind of repetitive, be strong and courageous, or be strong and of good courage. Right? He's commanded several times. And also commanded to meditate on the book of the law day and night. That's certainly a very important thing for any leader to do. Okay, I have a handout today. I think I've got 11 or so of these, so there's probably one for every family, I think. Almost enough for one for every person. I just got this off the web, so I can't vouch for its accuracy in every detail, but it does show where, it's sufficient for what we need. Basically, where they were at, somewhere around the R or D in the word River Jordan, there, about in the middle of the map, if you see where Jericho is, they were across the Jordan from Jericho. Incidentally, Moses, if you may recall this, was told by God basically to go up Mount Nebo where he would die. And God, it says that God himself buried Moses. Mount Nebo is somewhere north of the town labeled Dibon there. So This is sort of the general region they were in. And anyways, Joshua then sent some spies. He just sent two this time, and I don't know if that number is significant, but last time they had sent 12, and there were two faithful. This time he sent two, and there were two faithful. So, you know, they were supposed to spy secretly to view the land, especially Jericho. Okay, the two spies went into Jericho, and they lodged at the house of a prostitute, Rahab. And this is one of my favorite stories from the book, so we'll read this. Now Joshua, this is from Joshua 2, now Joshua the son of Nun sent out two men from Acacia Grove, and that's where they were camped at, to spy secretly, saying, "Go view the land, especially Jericho." So they went and came to the house of a harlot named Rahab and lodged there. And it was told the king of Jericho, saying, "Behold, men have come here tonight from the children of Israel to search out the country." So the king of Jericho went to Rahab, saying, "Bring out the men who have come to you, who have entered your house, for they have come to search out all the country." Then the women took the two men and hid them. So she said, "Yes, the men came to me, but I did not know where they were from. And it happened as the gate was being shut when it was dark that the men went out. Where the men went, I do not know. Pursue them quickly, for you may overtake them." But she had brought them up to the roof and hidden them with the stalks of flax which she had laid in order on the roof. Then the men pursued them by the road to the Jordan, to the fords. And as soon as those who had pursued them had gone out, they shut the gate. Now before they lay down, she came up to them on the roof and said to the men, "I know that the Lord has given you the land, that the terror of you has fallen on us, and that all the inhabitants of the land are faint-hearted because of you. For we have heard how the Lord dried up the water of the Red Sea for you when you came out of Egypt. And what you did to the two kings of the Amorites who were on the other side of the Jordan, Sihon and Og, whom you utterly destroyed. And as soon as we heard these things, our hearts melted. Neither did there remain any more courage in anyone because of you, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth beneath. Now therefore, I beg you, swear to me by the Lord, since I have shown you kindness, that you also will show kindness to my father's house, and give me a true token, and spare my father, my mother, my brothers, my sisters, and all that they have, and deliver our lives from death." So the men answered her, "Our lives are yours, if none of you will tell this business of ours. And it shall be when the Lord has given us the land that we will deal kindly and truly with you." Then she let them down by a rope through the window, for her house was on the city wall. She dwelt on the wall. And she said to them, "Go, get to the mountain, lest the pursuers meet you. Hide there 3 days until the pursuers have returned. Afterwards you may go your way." So the men said to her, "We will be blameless of this oath of yours, which you have made us swear, unless when we come into the land you bind this line of scarlet cord in the window through which you let us down. Unless you bring your father, your mother, your brothers, and all your father's household to your own home. So it shall be that whoever goes outside the doors of your house into the street, his blood shall be on his own head. We will be guiltless. Whoever is with you in the house, his blood shall be on our head if a hand is laid on him. And if you tell this business of ours, then we will be free from your oath, which you made us swear." Then she said, "According to your words, so be it." And she sent them away, and they departed, and she bound the scarlet cord in the window. They departed and went to the mountain and stayed there 3 days until the pursuers returned. The pursuers sought them all along the way, but did not find them. So the two men returned, descended from the mountain, and crossed over. And they came to Joshua, the son of Nun, and told him all that had befallen them. And they said to Joshua, "Truly the Lord has delivered all the land into our hands, for indeed all the inhabitants of the country are faint-hearted because of us." Okay, well, there's a number of things from this passage that I thought I would call your attention to. The first point, which you probably haven't missed, is that Rahab was a harlot, a prostitute. And as you'll see, she plays figuratively in the rest of biblical history. So some people have been embarrassed by this. And as Calvin said, why some try to avoid the name harlot and interpret the Hebrew word as a meaning, one who keeps an inn, I see not, unless it be that they think it disgraceful to be the guest of a courtesan, or wish to wipe off a stigma from a woman who not only received the messengers kindly, but secured their safety by singular courage and prudence. Moreover, in the fact that a woman who had gained a shameful livelihood by prostitution was shortly after admitted into the body of the chosen people and became a member of the church, we are furnished with a striking display of divine grace, which could thus penetrate into a place of shame and draw forth from it not only Rahab, but her father and other members of her family. Yeah. I was going to say that the fact that she does become part of the body, believers, it's a very clear picture of the God's grace toward us sinners, who might like to think we're better than a prostitute. There's one quote from Schaefer. After all, Rahab did not stand with the people of God as an unclean harlot. She had come under the blood of the coming Christ and was the harlot cleansed. Is Rahab any worse than we? If it is not fitting that she should be the ancestor of Christ, is it fitting that we should be the bride of Christ? Woe to anybody who has such a mentality as to be upset by Rahab. Such a person does not understand sin, the horribleness of the whole race turning into a prostitute against the living Creator. We all stand in Rahab's place on the side of the holy God. Probably we are even worse, for she had little knowledge. There is probably no one reading this book who has as little knowledge as Rahab had when she made her step of faith. We are all sinners. Each one of us is like this woman living up there on the wall. Each one of us deserves only one thing, the flaming judgment of God. If it were not for the spiritual portion of the covenant of grace and Christ's death on Calvary's cross, we would all be lost. So, anyways, I thought that was an important point. I don't know. I haven't heard anybody recently try to tell me that Rahab wasn't a prostitute. So I don't know. Maybe it's a dead issue. So she also deserted her own country, and she told a lie. And there's some question about this. The first question is whether or not it was justifiable to desert her country, and the other is whether or not it was justifiable for her to tell a lie. And let's see, probably with respect to her country, Pink said, "It is indeed the duty of a saint to seek the good of that country which affords him both shelter and subsistence. Nevertheless, he is bound to love God and his people more than his country and fellow citizens." Right? So, I think that seems to be a pretty clear case of, where does your allegiance lie? As to the lie itself, some people have said that that's a sort of justification for us under some circumstances to tell, to tell similar lies. And Calvin said, "As to the falsehood, we must admit that though it was done for a good purpose, it was not free from fault. For those who hold what is called a dutiful lie to be altogether excusable do not sufficiently consider how precious truth is in the sight of God. Therefore, although our purpose be to assist our brethren, to consult for their safety and relieve them, it never can be lawful to lie, because that cannot be right which is contrary to the nature of God, and God is truth. And still the act of Rahab is not devoid of the praise of virtue, although it was not spotlessly pure. For it often happens that while the saints study to hold the right path, they deviate into circuitous courses." If you're interested in more on this, I would commend to you reading this section in the book by Arthur Pink. He goes on at some length about this. And I particularly appreciate his opening to this. He says, "One of the most difficult tasks which confronts a Christian writer is that of commenting on the offenses of God's dear people. That on the one hand, he may not dip his pen in the Pharisaic ink of self-superiority, and that on the other hand, he does not make light of any evil or condone what is reprehensible. He is himself compassed with infirmity and a daily transgressor of God's law, and should be duly affected by a realization of the same when dealing with the faults of his fellows. Nevertheless, if he be a servant of God, preaching or writing to the saints, then he must remember that it is, quote, required in stewards that a man be found faithful. And he is most certainly unfaithful, even from a desire to be charitable, if he deliberately lowers God's standard of holiness, minimizes that which contravenes it, or glosses over anything which is culpable. Much grace and wisdom is needed if he is to act in both the spirit of meekness and righteousness of compassion and fidelity." And then Pink goes on to go on some at some length or it's over three single-spaced pages that I just copied and pasted into the back of my document. He says, "The prevarications of Rahab under the king's officers is appealed to by the Jesuits in support of their pernicious dogma. The end justifies the means." So if this is of interest to you, I really recommend reading this. I mean, I thought it was quite good, and he says, "We frankly acknowledge, though to our shame, that were we placed in a similar situation to the one which confronted Rahab, and God should leave us to ourselves, we would acquit ourselves no better than she did, and probably for worse." But anyway, he discusses this in some depth, and I thought his discussion was quite useful. So, okay, let's see. Rahab gave the spies shelter, and from the mouth of an enemy, this enemy being Rahab, the spies heard the truth about what would happen. Right, and this happens. It happens later in Scripture, right, when Gideon sneaks into the Midianite camp. And I forget their exact words, but basically they're telling each other, we're about to be destroyed. So Gideon takes that as a good sign. And the spies took it as a good sign when they went back and reported it. Another interesting thing is Rahab says the hearts of the people were faint. You know, they were panicked. They were stricken. Yet, did they say, let's send out a envoy to try to negotiate the best terms possible? No. No, they planned to resist. And, I'm sure this was God's will for them. We see, as Calvin says, we see that when the wicked are broken and crushed by the hand of God, they are not so subdued as to receive the yoke. But in their terror and anxiety, they become incapable of being tamed. So, I mean, I think this is much like the hardening of Pharaoh's heart, right? It's hardening of the hearts of the people. The spies were faithful. Notice they said when they promised to Rahab, they said, when we come into the land, not if we come into the land. Let's see, Rahab, harlot, prostitute, in a hostile heathen land, yet she had heard what happened to Sion and Og, and she believed. She said, for the Lord your God, he is God in heaven above and on earth below. And we don't know how it is she came to believe, but she did. And she's later cited twice in the New Testament as an example of faith. One is Hebrews 2:31. By faith the harlot Rahab did not perish with those who did not believe, but she had received the spies with peace. And also James 2:25. Likewise, was not Rahab the harlot also justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? For as the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. So I certainly don't have time to go with it at faith and or being justified by works in depth here, fortunately for me. But the clearly, Rahab had faith, and she demonstrated it by, you know, pact she made with the spies, the fact that she followed their instructions, that she sent them on their way, so on. Okay, the scarlet cord, right? That she was to hang a scarlet cord in her window, and that, without making too big a deal out of it, because the Bible doesn't really tell us too much more about this. It's very sort of reminiscent, though, of the Passover blood being sprinkled on the doors, right? She put the scarlet cord in the window. Every other household was destroyed but her household. Schaefer says that from the time of the early church, it's been thought to be a sign of Christ's blood, you know, like the Passover blood. So, okay, and finally, not only did Rahab join herself to the believer, she's an ancestor of Christ. And that's an ancestor of David, and that's apparently the reason why some writers, including some rabbinic writers, you know, wanted to say she wasn't a prostitute. But in let's see, Matthew 1:5, we're told Salmon begot Boaz by Rahab, Boaz begot Obed by Ruth, Obed begot Jesse, and this is all in the line of Christ. Okay, well, that probably makes a good place to stop for today. We've gotten in our overview to chapter 2 of Joshua, so I'm following in the great tracks of my predecessor here. I really hope to finish in 2 or 3 weeks, so that's my goal. But then again, I don't always make my goals. So, we'll see. I'll ask if there are any questions. I don't know if I can answer them, but any questions or discussion, points people want to add to the discussion? Chuck, I saw your mouth start to open there. Okay. Okay, well, in that case, then, we will stop.